Welcome to Marfa Mondays with your host, award-winning travel writer and novelist, C.M. Mayo.
Welcome to the sixth podcast in the Marfa Monday series of 24 monthly podcasts, which run from the beginning of 2012 through to the end of 2013. I'm your host, C.M. Mayo, and these podcasts are part of the work of a book I'm writing about Far West Texas. Here we are in June of 2012, and I don't have a title for the book yet, but if you're listening a couple of years from now, well, I do hope the book not only has a title, but has been published, in which case I invite you to visit my website, cmmayo.com, and read all about it. On my website at cmmayo.com/Marfa, you can also read all about this podcast series and listen in to the other podcasts, which so far include my introduction, posted in January 2012, an interview with Charlie Angel in the Big Bend, February 2012, an interview with Mary Bones, curator of the Lost Colony Show of Regional Texas Painting at the Museum of the Big Bend. That was in March of 2012. An interview with a very talented young artist, Avram Dumitrescu, ran in April of 2012. And last month, May 2012, the podcast was an interview with Cynthia McAllister about the curious native bees and the vital role of pollinators in this area, which is the northern Chihuahua Desert. This month, June 2012, the podcast is my interview recorded last month with Paul Graybeal, the owner of Marfa's fabulous rock shop, Moonlight Gemstones. Now, I know some of you listening don't know where exactly Marfa is, but I'll bet you can picture the shape of the state of Texas. At the far left corner, at the border with Mexico and the state of New Mexico, we have El Paso. Over to the far right corner of the state, close to Louisiana, we have Houston. At the bottom, where we have on the one side the Gulf of Mexico and on the south, Mexico, that would be Brownsville. Now, the border between Texas and Mexico, heading from there back up northwest toward El Paso, in a wiggly way, indeed with a big bend in it, is the Rio Grande. In the middle of Texas is its capital, Austin. So roughly a third of the way between El Paso and Austin is Marfa. If you drive from Austin west to Marfa, you'd need about 7 hours. If you wanted to drive out east to Marfa from El Paso, that would take you about 3.5 hours. I always like to stop in Van Horn for the huevos con machaca and coffee at Chewy's, so it takes me about 4 hours plus. Because some other towns are mentioned in this podcast, I want to give you a sense of where these are. Almost directly south and a little bit southeast of Marfa are the Big Bend Ranch State Park and the Big Bend National Park, which border on Mexico. The town of Alpine is about 1/2 hour east of Marfa. Fort Davis is about 1/2 hour mostly north. And Terlingua is about 2 hours southeast in the mountains, not on the border, but very close to the border with Mexico. As you might imagine, Marfa is a very small, very remote town, but it has become well known far beyond the borders of Texas for its art community, the many accomplished artists and writers in residence, full or part-time, the Judd Foundation, Chinati Foundation, Ballroom Marfa, and several other foundations and galleries, as well as a thriving music scene. I'll be covering that in later podcasts. What I'm interested in now, still at the beginning of writing my book, is the lay of the land. By which I mean the greater Big Bend region, which of course includes Marfa. And the land is, well, as historian Walter Prescott Webb called it, an earth wreck in which a great section of country was shaken down, turned over, blown up, and set on fire. In other words, there have been, over the past many millions of years, some geological events, evidence of which is abundant, not only in these big craggy mountains and ridges, but in stones from mammoth piles of boulders down to the tiniest pebbles. Well, so we're standing in the front part of the Moonlight Gemstones shop on Highway 90 in Marfa. It's beautiful. Do you want to tell me what you've got here?
Well, I guess, a typical rock shop. I have things from all over that I've found to be popular over the years. But the niche that I have that other rock shops wouldn't have would be a collection of local items. I'm probably one of the only persons that's really offering up for retail a nice variety of Texas agates, including Marfa agate. Quite rare. You can see the bouquet type here. Let me pull up a tray. And This is just something you don't see in the marketplace. So,
These are beautiful.
That's my niche. And these also.
Oh, they're beautiful. Let's see how I would describe these to people listening. They look like crystal. They have little bits of leaves in them, but they're beautiful and shiny. And some of them are black, and some of them are midnight blue, and smoky and opal-like. And then the other tree over here has this beautiful burnt orange color and coral color.
This variety here is the local pet name is bouquet agate for the floral patterns that they oftentimes take. And the pastel colors. So we have a variety of agates in each of the areas, the lava flows that produce agate in the area. Each location, like Alpine, is quite distinctive and different from the Marfa material. There is some crossover. I mean, both sites have plumes. And if you go down to Tolingue area, the Needle Peak agate, there's more of a sagenite and pseudomorphs, etc. Yellows and greens as opposed to blacks and reds and yellows.
So I'm surprised that the Alpine and Marfa are so different because they're not that far. They're about half hour on the highway?
Well, they're about 15 miles apart as a crow flies, but these are individual geological events which produce the agates.
Are they both 35 million years ago? Well, is that
approximately,
right?
Approximately, yes.
So one came after the other, or they were just separate events?
Well, separate events. They would be different volcanoes producing the environment in which the agates formed. Like south of Alpine, you have two distinct geological features. One's called the Cottonwood Springs, which produce the red plume agate that the Woodward Ranch is famous for.
So these reddish ones are from that ranch?
From the Woodward Ranch, yes.
Oh, now these are the polished, like they're oval shapes.
We call these cabochons, or cabs. Cabs for short. Cabochon being a French word for dome, or a dome cut, as opposed to a facet.
So this is what you make the jewelry out of, earrings, pendants, bolos, and cufflinks, and things like that. Well, 35 million years old.
Well, that's when the volcanic activity occurred. We don't really know when agates formed. We assume they formed after the lava has cooled, or that while there's still heat active underneath these formations, pushing steam or water. Quartz is water soluble at high temperatures, so one of the theories is that the quartz is being deposited from hydrothermal activity.
So the agates might have actually taken a very long time to form after the geological event.
We don't really know how long it takes an agate to form. We have not produced agates in a lab per se. We can produce quartz, but we still haven't produce the conditions where we have inclusions like this. And this is a different form of quartz. It's a microcrystalline quartz as opposed to the feudal quartz that they manufacture for the electronic industry.
Can you tell me about what you have in the store? You're mostly specializing in agate.
That's my main interest, or what got me into the rot shop, is Clifton Agate as a hobby when I first moved out here in the 80s. Of course, I grew up in the Black Hills, and that's real rich in minerals and of course, fossils in the Badlands, all that sort of stuff. So at a very young age, I'm sure I was exposed to looking at the ground and looking for treasures on the ground sort of thing.
Well, that's actually something very unusual for most people in 21st century America. I grew up in the suburbs in California, and I've lived in cities all my life. I mean, I'm looking at the sidewalk. And if I'm not looking at the sidewalk, it's grass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you really grew up going out searching for these things.
Well, being inclined to appreciate nature or less populated parts of the world. I tried living in cities a couple times, but I'm much, much better off out here in the wilderness.
What made you want to come here?
Well, I had taken a job at the observatory, and I worked up there 9 years, and that's where I'd started collecting agates as a hobby. Anyway, I lived on the hill, and the hill itself had little quartz called chalcedony roses. They shaped like roses, and maybe had a little quartz crystal on them.
Yeah.
But, picking a few up around my house, then I was informed about the Wooded Ranch, about the agates in the area, and that one thing led to another. I'd lost that job in 93, and I'd moved away for about 3 years. I'd taken some various jobs. As a matter of fact, I'd moved, I think, 9 times in those 3 years.
Wow.
But at any rate, I worked my way back and found a place to rent here in Marfa, and eventually I bought this place here in it's about 2004, perhaps, somewhere back in those.
So it's been about 8 years.
Mm-hmm, since I've actually bought in. And off and on, I've had various opportunities to collect in sites south of town. I don't publicize the places out of respect for the landowners, not to have hordes of people approaching them about the privileges that I've been given, and typically I'm allowed to collect and trade for jewelry back for the family, or in a couple of cases where I've met new landowners, they're interested in their agates, and I've been out just to educate them and to show them hunting techniques and what to look for, those sort of things. And in large part, a lot of what I've acquired has been from purchasing other collections. That's happened on a number of occasions over the last 20 years, where I've picked up a lifetime collection I bought out the inventory of several other rock shops in the area.
So, I'm looking around, and it looks really packed with all sorts of stuff. You seem to have all kinds of things in here.
Once a year, I go to Tucson, which is the big show, and then that's where I buy the things that I know sell well, like the pyrite cubes. These are a big hit.
It's bright silver. It looks like a die, like, the dice. Mm. It's like a perfect little cube. It looks man-made, but it's not.
It's a natural crystal, yeah, and they're very popular here in Donald Judd Land.
Oh, right, yes. It looks just like the Donald Judd cubes in the...
Of course, in Host Rock, and everybody loves amethyst, and it's birthstone, so I have to have the amethyst cathedrals down there from Brazil.
Oh, yeah, they're big. They're all along the floor. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. They look about 2, 3 feet high, maybe. They're purple, like Kool-Aid grape juice and sparkly. And then you have a giant snail fossil.
Ammonite. Yeah,
an ammonite.
On my front door, I have three that are from, sitting outside. I have three of them that are from here in Texas. That one was actually from Morocco. It's nice that I actually had a road worker bring me in a few from Texas. It's nice to have Texas fossils, and you can see in the middle room there's still more varieties.
So we're going into the middle room now.
Fossil fish from Wyoming, they're very popular. Trilobites, popular with kids.
And where are the trilobites from?
Well, these are from Utah, and then these are from Morocco.
Morocco. They're bigger, the ones from Morocco. Are those shark teeth?
Mm-hmm.
And where are those from?
Morocco, but also have some here from a couple other locations, the East Coast.
Yeah, I've heard you can often find them on the beach in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the West Texas fossils here,
mm-hmm.
Several of those. Oh, from Alaska.
That was a collection of somebody who lived up in Alaska. And
what are these? These look like bugged out arrowheads. They're like, 4 inches long?
They come in a variety of sizes, but their Latin name is Orthoceras. This is a very old fossil, about 400 million years old.
400 million.
Eventually curled up and evolved into ammonites. They were a squid-like creature.
Oh, the ancestor of the ammonites.
They're chambered exoskeleton.
And then here's the ammonite halves, these tiny ones.
I have some bigger ones up here that have been cut and polished, and you can see the interior. Actually geode in technical terms, in that the hollow part of the rock has crystals.
They're gorgeous. And then you have some strange things up here.
We do have wild boars out here. So this is a wild pig. And that's a small bear, a brown bear.
These are skulls. We're looking at the skulls.
Mountain lion.
Ooh, he has teeth.
Of course, I have some skulls out on my fence out there, too.
No, the teeth on that mountain lion skull, they look like they're for a dentist's office. They're just perfect and pearly white.
This was acquired through New Mexico Fish and Game. You can see it's tagged.
You have some big lumpy-looking things. There's this rock that looks like a lot of little roses.
Desert rose.
Desert rose.
The mineral is bladed selenite. And this is aragonite, and it's got some kind of iron coating.
It looks like coral.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's coral color.
People mistaken. You can see the other aragonite. Well, actually, these are probably a calcium carbonate, same as a calcite crystal. Uh-huh. I think the aragonite is a misnomenclature on this particular crystal form.
Now, how would I describe those? They look to me like... like exotic mushrooms.
Or coral.
Yes, or coral. But if I saw that in a mossy forest, I would think it was a mushroom.
yeah, they could, different fungi take different...
And then we have these shiny things. These are glittery, like disco clothes.
Fool's gold. And right next to it is fool's gold with copper in it, the chalcopyrite. And you can see the
iridescent peacock ore. Beautiful. And,
multicolored calcites that are popular amongst people that don't know much about rocks. That so the shiny colors.
Yeah, to put it on your table in a bowl, that mm-hmm. would be beautiful. And the green, is that malachite?
Yes, this is a fibrous malachite.
Oh.
It's not something that we want to cut into gemstones. It's more of a, you can see it looks kind of like a tiger eye with the fibrous crystal structure.
Looks almost like a sponge. Like, I know it's not soft, but if you told me it was a sponge, I would believe it. It looks spongy. Wow.
All the minerals in here, that was part of a single collection that I acquired in... it had been sitting in a storage facility for the last 15 years, but it was a collection that a rock shop in Alpine had bought and had displayed in a museum. It was only open for a couple of years, Indus Rock Shop. She had acquired several collections, and when she passed away, her daughter just put it all in storage. And about 2.5 years ago, she cleared it out, and I was fortunate that I was recommended. Inside there was, the collection of Tom Harkey with his minerals, thousands of pieces. You see a majority of them still in their boxes are flat. I don't have space to put them out. Most of them aren't very valuable. They're a lot of common stuff, but it's nice to have, out of it. There was 20 or 30 that were pretty remarkable, I'd say. Of course, the most unique collectors coming in spot a good deal. I'm not a collector of minerals, so I bought this collection. I put it out for sale.
Well, you must get people who are very knowledgeable. I mean, I'm pretty clueless. I just like describing the things I see, but you must get people who are really experts coming in here.
Maybe once a month or so I'll get somebody that's, still I'm on the front street and I'm a retail store and I'm really off the beaten path. So,
well, not completely, because anybody who comes into Marfa is going to go by your store. You're right on Highway 90.
But still, it's a town of 3,000 people and we don't have skiing. The only attractions we have are the ballroom and the Shinati and...
Yeah.
And of course, we're between the parks, so I've always maintained a good track record with people visiting the natural beauty of the area. Marfa lights, we have a very specific attraction, which I don't always get to people visiting the Donald Judd Foundation, let's say.
Right.
That person interested in minimal art might not stop at a rock shop, you know, with skulls hanging on his back fence, you know. That's not high art, you know.
Well, but some of the jewelry you make is extraordinary. Yeah, I saw it on the website.
Getting to use our local stones makes it quite unique, and if you like the style that I do, then I do have a niche. And if you'd like to see the outside a little bit.
But before we go outside, could I quick ask you, what are these? They're green stones, beautifully polished, with lots of little bubbles in them.
They call this ocean jasper. It's from Madagascar. You can see some big slabs over there. They come in big granite-like rocks. And here in the last 5 or 6 years, they've been highly promoted at the shows, and it's a good seller. So they're little orbs. Sometimes they're little crystal structures that make it look like flowers around a dot in the stone. That's a kind of a common pattern. They're not exceptional for cabochons because they end up having a lot of ugs or little pockets with a small druzy crystalline.
But they're lovely to display use as a paperweight.
A worry stone. This year, there are about 2 bags of these. I'm down to 6 of them. But they're inexpensive, and that's the nice thing about having a shop that I can have things that, you know, kids can afford. And parents can bring their kids and give them $5 or, you know, $20 each and a half an hour, that kind of thing. So,
what are your favorite gemstones?
I collect agate, and so my deal there is, you know, I have a nice, it's small, but it's a very intense collection. So if you wanted to take a look at it, well, we can go in the house and...
That'd be great. We're passing through the shop where you polish things, and you have a lot of different equipment in here.
A couple little trim saws and little grinders, and of course the workbench for the silver.
Where you make your jewelry. And there's a sign for the Big Bend Gem and Mineral Show.
Those are the 3 years I hosted it.
2006, 7, and 8?
I hosted it here in Marfa. It's since moved back to Alpine. Well, it's hosted by our gym club.
Ah, okay.
The Big Bend Gym and Mineral Club or Society.
Oh, and what is this machine doing?
That's my tumbler.
It's a tumbler.
Rocks in there tumbling away they call them baroque stones. And this is a slicer. Some of these I'll toss in the tumbler for a mass finish. If they're worth it, then I'll go ahead and grind them into a shape.
I wouldn't know how to describe that machine. It's turquoise blue, and it's got all sorts of complicated-looking innards. And it's about, 2.5 feet square,
this
maybe?
This is a 10-inch lapidary saw. It has a clamp which holds the rock, and it has a drive which will drive this clamp through the rock. The blade has diamond on the edge of it, so it's more of a grinding action. It has an oil lubrication, an oil bath, where the blade just picks up the oil as it rotates. And you want the oil to keep the stone cool and to keep dust down and things like that. With clamps in there, like, so the feed will drive it through. I have a cross feed so I can get accurate slices, like a loaf of bread from the stone. It has a chain on the switch, so when the drive pulls the carriage through, eventually the chain will pull the switch on, so I can walk away. The second process is put it into a kitty litter to clean the oil off, and then from there it'll go into soapy water.
Okay, so I'm looking at a pan of, this is kitty litter.
Yeah.
Okay, and then with the big metal spatula, you toss the sliced rocks around in there to get the oil off. What's your dog's name?
Tonk. Honky Tonk. And from here I can kind of grade out and see what... right now I don't think I have anything really highly valuable that, you know, I'm going to worry about. So most of these, next time I pick out stuff from a tumbler, I'll probably start here.
And this is a bench sitting out on the grass, and they're kind of like drying in the sun, right?
Well, it's just a staging area that prior to, if you look over there, you can see I have slabs assorted into buckets, so
Like if somebody wants a belt buckle or wants to pick something from a slab, then I've got that resource. They don't have to pick from a cabochon. We can look at pieces that are already slabbed.
So a person with a ranch could say, oh, I want a belt buckle made from something on my ranch.
Those folks usually bring me the rocks. Staging areas from here, you know, when I'm getting ready to cut from there, well, I have a couple little trays here. Pretty structured.
They look like cake pans. And they're full of polished slices of rocks.
Unpolished.
Or unpolished. Oh, well, they're getting so much sunshine, they look polished.
Right, right. If you want to see what they look like polished, I would get them wet. Rock hounds, they like to pick the rocks. Usually I'll have...
Ooh, that one's shiny. Okay, so we're spraying some water on them. Oh, they're so pretty. Turquoise and emerald colors and... That looks like a Chinese smoked duck egg. Like a milky color and a marshmallow color and, ooh, bright orange. Okay, so now we're going in the house.
This is a private collection of agate. The top shelf there is Marfa material, and then I have... Some from Alpine, some from Mexico, and Alpine, a mix is greener from the Southwest. The majority of this is local to the Big Bend region or the Chihuahuan Desert, but I do have a few things from other locations.
When you go into the Chihuahuan Desert, well, I know we're in Chihuahuan Desert now, but when you cross the border and go a little bit further south, does the type of rock change a lot?
We have some crossover. Where some of the material that I find here in Marfa can be found in Mexico. There is very distinctive fields down there that produce unique colored banded agates. This here's a, like they call that, a flame agate, Apache flame.
Oh, it's beautiful. It looks like a flame.
Each location, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like Needle Peak, some of that formation will be in Mexico. You know, it can crop up over there. I don't have a geological map to tell me exactly what in Mexico, but I do know that each mountain range has produces, like you got the Laguna agates and Moctezumas and Prisalis. So, you know, you have about 30 or 40 different locations in the northern Mexico that famously produce agate and has for many years. When people think about agate, it's usually a piece of Mexican banded agate that, or Lake Superior, you know, another famous.
Oh, Lake Superior.
Right.
That's a long way north.
Right. So, you know, there's only a few places where when people think of agates, they think, you know, where they've been really highly promoted. Mexico is one of them. Some experts say that Mexico produces the most beautiful agate in the world. Well, I disagree. I think Marfa does, but the trouble is Marfa hasn't been exploited, that it's not been made highly famous. Part of the reason is because it's all on private property and it's very difficult to get access. And then I don't think it is as widespread as some of the agate beds in Mexico, where when they first started to produce, there was enough for everybody who wanted a piece of agate to have a piece of agate and not have to pay $100 for it.
I would think that Marfa agate would become better known just because Marfa has a big presence on the internet.
Yeah, it's developing. And I, you know, over the last 5 years. I'm sure, you know, that I'm not a promoter like Charlie Angel, and I don't promote field trips like some folks do. You know, I treat my privileges like more like a person might have a claim, you know. Yeah. I make my living at it.
You have a lovely website, which is very informative. I was doing a little research of what I know almost nothing about this subject, but I researched what I could this morning on your website, and you had pictures and explained the different types of agate very well. But yeah, I see, though, that there's more and more about... I mean, the minute I decided to write my book on Marfa, the New York Times did all these pieces on Marfa. It's funny. It's like I thought, well, gee, I seem to just be one of the crowd here, and I thought I had picked a place to write about that nobody was writing about.
No, we have been highly... Marfa's been highly publicized, but, you know, out of all the New York and L.A. kind of articles, I've never been mentioned.
Well, I saw you on the Etsy video, though.
Okay, there
that was a good video.
Yeah, and yeah. I have about a half a second.
But it's a great one. It's a great one.
Yeah. But I'm not promoting my inventory through Etsy. And I'm sure if I had, they probably would have given me a little longer spot. But outside of that, I did get mentioned in an interior decorator magazine some 10 years ago that I had a line, you know, kind of thing. I'm coming to find out that a lot of folks use rocks for interior decorating, big, you know, kind of thing. So that makes sense. But you know, anybody writing about the Marfa scene, I'm down there with the guy that's wearing a funny hat and walking the street looking for handouts, kind of thing.
I think to me this is a big part of the whole region is gemstones, and I know people are really passionate about it.
To the naturalist, and I'll get my 10% from anybody across the board. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a millionaire with high art. If you have a rock bug, you're gonna make your way into my shop. So
yeah, well, you are the rock shop in Marfa, and you got to go a long way to find another rock shop.
No, there's rock shops in Alpine. There's a Fort Davis, and of course, Terlingua has. Historically, we got many stones down there, and there used to be the Maverick Rock Shop. That's been bought by another rock hound who lives there part time, kind of thing. He does shows. He's not going to open a rock shop, but they come and go. And this is a good area for him. We can, every town can support a rock shop because we do get enough tourists, and there's enough resources that we get away. People ask me how I'm doing. Well, I just say I get away with it. So I can get to sell rocks in the desert.
Let me ask you, what is that one that looks like an ice cube?
That is a very, very clear piece of quartz.
It looks like water.
A very exceptional piece.
Beautiful. And then you've got one that's a triangle.
Yeah, this is a pseudomorph. This would have been originally a different type of crystal that was replaced with quartz. It takes the diamond shape of the original. I assume it's like a dog tooth calcite kind of crystal.
Oh. It's just gorgeous with the mirror behind it and the light on it. It's like you feel different when you're looking at gems. When you hold them, they kind of have a vibe.
Some people are sensitive. I don't preach anything about stones. Their power on me was their beauty. But over the last 20 years or so, I suppose, there's been a renaissance in the belief in gems' spiritual or healing properties. I don't want to discount or belittle anybody's belief systems, but I'm only going to talk about what you could take into the laboratory and prove. Mm-hmm. If you're sensitive, I try not to dislodge your belief system, but accept that, you know, some people are sensitive, so... So many rock shops now have gone to just crystal palaces for the exploitation of that aspect of
Sort of new age healing.
Right.
And if you have this one, it hits your seventh chakra, kind of thing. Yeah,
but stay away from preaching anything other than their natural beauty or the rarity that, as I understand them, you know.
Well, the natural beauty is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I'm just.
You know, colors can heal. I mean,
they're beautiful.
There's a certain amount of science to various aspects of, you know, what may have an influence in our immune systems, et cetera.
I think so. Well, they're just gazing upon the beauty, the emerald and the rose and the tulip red and that deep, deep Kelly green, emerald green, the purples and all the interesting patterns. Like little pearls. Absolutely beautiful. Oh, thank you for showing me that. That was just really special. Well, now you also make jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
We can.
So we're going by the roller. It's still rolling. The tumbler.
Yeah, that will be till the bearings roll, wear out. Once a week, I'll check them approximately, rotate them. Now I'll show you what
thank you.
The end product of the tumbler is.
Oh, great. Okay.
A lot of these are from Mexico, but here's one from from the area.
Oh, it looks like a guitar pick. But it's got all this stuff in it, like little leaves.
The plume. And the rough nodule. These here are all local. But this
local
is a
agates, $2 each in a big bin. You know, one thing I noticed as I was hiking around out here, actually down more by La Junta de los Rios, Presidio, Chinati Hot Springs, when you're walking, at first it feels like you've just got all these rocks. But they're all different sizes, and they're all different shapes, and they're all clearly composed of something different. And the variety of just, I mean, I walked like half an hour down the canyon at Chinati Hot Springs, and it was just over and over just the variety of size and shape and content. And I would see some that had, I think it was called the peanut agate.
Mm-hmm.
That must be a piece of pottery with cement on it. No, it's actually a rock.
A conglomerate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have quite a lot of conglomerate out here, like ash or something is cemented some previous agates together. The peanut agate is formed differently. This here would be like a piece of a peanut agate where... And they would form inside.
Looks like little kind of peanuts.
Right. Yeah. Oftentimes they're orange color.
Uh-huh.
I probably don't have a good example out here right now.
What are the most popular things that people like to buy when they come into your shop?
Well, there's the inexpensive stuff. So, of course, now collectors, agate collectors that know how rare Marfa agate, or if they want something from the area, then this is an easy sell.
These are the Alpine, and these are the Marfa. The Marfas are a different color. Like, this is the one that looks to me like the smoked duck egg. Dark midnight blue, black, milky purple.
No.
And then the Alpine ones have more coral color in them. And the Terlingua has a bit of green. And they're all next to each other. So you get the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going out to the front door. Oh, you've got all kinds of stuff out here.
Mm-hmm.
The big ammonites and what is that big green thing?
Those are calcites.
Looks like a giant green sponge. Wow.
Geodes, and then of course I have rough between the buildings.
Piles of all kinds of rocks.
Geodes, rough agate, stone planters.
These look like eggs. Gray eggs.
Geodes.
These are geodes.
Nice choice.
So when you open them, they have that beautiful purple and crystal inside.
Some will have amethyst, maybe about 10%.
About 10%. So you just don't know until you open them.
Right.
They look like orbs.
These are technically geodes, and they have an agate skin to them. Some of these will be hollow, so they won't technically be a geode. But I do have another variety of geode over here that form differently. These are called thunder eggs.
Thunder eggs.
Yeah, over here. These form while the ash and the pyro clastic flows is still hot. These things are produced by the steam, by the chemical reaction associated with the violent explosion.
It's kind of greenish-brown, and some are the size of a chicken egg, but some look pretty big, like the size of a football almost.
Well, there's one over there that's the size of a basketball, and I've seen some much bigger.
What area are these from?
These are all out of Mexico. Well, you know, when I discovered the Wooded Ranch, I went out there for about 2 years and picked up rocks, and I didn't have a saw, I didn't have any way to process it. And at that time, Susie Woodward was running the show with her husband, and she asked me, what are you going to do with all these things? So finally, I bought a saw, and I started to cut, and bought a used grinder and started grinding the cabochons. And a couple more years went by, and I had this big collection of cabochons. And at the time, my wife said, what are you going to do with all those cabochons? And 1989, I started moonlighting. That's when I took up my business, and I took a summer course at Sol Ross to learn fabrication techniques for silver, and been making it ever since.
Ah.
I call myself Moonlight because it's originated as a part-time business, and up until 96 when I moved here full-time. I've been doing this full-time. And it's all handmade. I don't personally cast, but I'll use cast items. Like I'll buy flowers and I have a friend in the Hill Country who's casting authentic arrowheads, so I'll sell the arrowheads as charms and pendants, and in some cases I'll incorporate the little arrowheads into jewelry. On the sides, rings, and I do have some arrowhead earrings, that sort of thing.
Oh, that was so interesting that you learned how to do that.
I get asked a lot about how do you learn this sort of thing. Well, for me, I was motivated, and I'm self-taught for the most part in grinding the rocks, that sort of thing. I know in the big cities there's oftentimes clubs where people can meet other craft people and learn. You know, the big cities, they have good clubs, clubhouses, and people can rent the machines. In my case, I people that are curious, over the years, I've taught a lot of people just the basics. You know, learning to cut a stone. You know, it took me a year to get efficient at it. I can teach somebody in a few hours, so a lot of tricks that took me a long time to learn. You know, that you just can't get out of a book. You know, that you
got to learn by doing.
Right. So long as a person is motivated, it's good to have an experienced person to give a few pointers, I say. But for the most part, if you're motivated and you want to learn it, I think the majority of people are learning the craft probably learn it by themselves. It takes that kind of motivation.
Do you participate in the Trappings of Texas show, or is that something different?
No, that's for cowboys.
Oh, okay. They don't want bolos? This is a bolo, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's beautiful bolo. Turquoise, rimmed in silver.
Yeah, the Trappings of Texas is bits and spurs and engraving, real traditional cowboy. This is more of an Indian style, just not part of the cowboy culture.
I always thought it was that they would wear bolos.
Well, if they did wear a bolo, and maybe there's a little turquoise, but they're going to have a little scroll work. They're going to have, there's a very specific, if you go into Montana silversmith, it's all nickel engraved. There's a very, very cataloged niche, say, that the spurs, you know, the spurs are decorated. They're going to be the scroll work, you know, the engraving.
So it's really a different tradition.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, the cowboys, they'll have all the flowery work done on their guns and, you know.
The person could come and say, they could say, well, I want to get a bolo. And they could just look at all the cabochons, and then you would make it for them.
Right. That's mainly how I work, is I'm mostly by commission.
Is this lapis lazuli?
Yes.
From Afghanistan?
Yes.
I thought so. And then there's a purple one.
That's amethyst?
The pink is pink amethyst? Or?
No, that would be rhodochrosite. It's a magnesium mineral from Argentina.
The whole world is in here.
Right.
The reason you just heard some crinkling sounds in there is that I edited some of this out. I had just purchased a pair of earrings, agate and silver. While I waited, Paul went in the back and polished them for me. Beautiful. So these were found near Alpine.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find them?
I have a picture of the fellow who found these.
Oh, really?
He hunted for 50 years. Never sold any. It was just a hobby. Dr. Ely.
Dr. Ely, E-L-Y.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And his collection of cabochons sold. There was over 5,000 of them, and about 1,200 of them were from the Alpine and the Big Bend area.
And he made the cabochons himself.
Right. Never sold them. They ended up as a collection in his rock shop in Alpine as a part of a museum. Now it's in my hands. So.
And you made the jewelry. You made the silver.
Ben made the jewelry on this particular one.
Oh, he made the jewelry on this one.
Right. So somebody else cut stones, but I have cut some of these. These are the ones I've cut. But there again, like I say, my work sells about as fast as I can make it. So, you know, I only have a few pieces in. I'll struggle to, you know, the elbow time to.
You don't want to go on Etsy?
Well,
because I'll bet you'd sell a bunch on there.
I can't make it any faster.
That's a good problem to have.
You know, I can have my son make. You know, I can hire people to make it, but for myself, I hardly have anything in there because it's mostly by commission. These were almost empty, but now that springtime was here, I've got out, and that was my goal, to fill these two up. But this is almost empty. I need to do something to fill this one up too. So,
So you just bit by bit, you add your cabochons to the.
When the weather's nice, I like to work outside. I've got a little machine in here, but it's not good for So a lot of this stuff is going to be seasonal. Right now, it's springtime. I'm going to crank out as many stones as I can. Come the fall, Christmas time, I'm going to be trying to produce inventory for the case.
So these are your big seasons, for like the spring and the fall with Christmas coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person wanted to commission something from you, could they just talk to you on the phone or through your website?
I have to admit, my website, I get an awful lot of requests through there, but I get very few actual orders. Uh-huh. I think people need to be here to make decisions. I got a size, you know, if it's for the wrist. But we do have our jewelry online, and people that know me, know my shop, oftentimes will buy something from there. And occasionally we'll get a stranger that discovers me and buys off the web, but that accounts for maybe 2% of my sales. They're very, very insignificant. It is a good advertisement where people visiting Marfa.
Yeah.
An awful lot of people coming in and say, well, I've seen your website. You know, a lot of people.
I saw your brochure in the Paisano Hotel.
Mm-hmm. That's a good place. I get more people from the Paisano than any other source.
I can believe it.
Tune in for Marfa Mondays with your host, CM Mayo, at cmmayo.com/podcasts.
Travel from your armchair. About CM Mayo's Miraculous Air, Library Journal says, with elegant prose and an artist's eye for detail, Mayo may just have written one of the best books ever about Baja California. Highly recommended. The Los Angeles Times Book Review calls Miraculous Air a luminous exploration of Baja California, from its southern tip at Cabo San Lucas to its lost city of Tijuana. Mayo takes the fiction writer's impulse and blends it with the instincts of a journalist to create a work of nonfiction that elides into modern myth. Miraculous Air, Journey of 1,000 Miles Through Baja California, The Other Mexico, by C.M. Mayo, is available in a paperback edition from Milkweed Editions, and now also as an ebook from Dancing Chiva. Look for Miraculous Air in bookstores and from all major online booksellers.
Traveler's Literary Companion. The Los Angeles Times Book Review calls it a book to throw in a suitcase on the way to Mexico or just settling into a favorite patio chair. It will open your eyes and fill you with pleasure. Mexico Connect says, discovering it was like opening a door and walking into a brightly lit room filled with all kinds of literary treasures. Mexico, a Traveler's Literary Companion, 24 Mexican writers on Mexico, selected by award-winning writer and translator C.M. Mayo, is available from Whereabouts Press. Look for it in bookstores and all major online booksellers. Hear a country speak. Find out more about Mexico, a Traveler's Literary Companion, at cmmayo.com.